We'll get started with the delayed rulemaking hearing on educator preparation and licensing. The State Board will now conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the rules of educator preparation and licensing, 1 CCR 301-37. The Board approved the notice of rulemaking at its September 9th, 2015 Board meeting. The hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through the publication of a public notice on September 25th, 2015, through the Colorado Register, and by the State Board notice on November 4th, 2015. State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to CRS 22-2-107, paren 1, paren C. Commissioner, is the staff ready to provide an overview?
Yes, we are. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll turn this over to Dr. Colleen O'Neill and Dr. Katie Anthes to take us through the review.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Colleen O'Neill. I'm the Executive Director of Educator Preparation and Licensing. With me today is Dr. Katie Anthes, who is our Interim Associate Commissioner of Achievement and Strategy. Today is the hearing on the updated educator preparation and licensing rules. I'm going to set the stage just a little bit for us, and then we will be able to kind of turn it over to our audience members and our stakeholders for public testimony. We will just continue on with setting the stage. Today, just so that you know, it is not an action item in front of you. The purpose of today is really to review the process that we've used to create the current draft of the updated rules, share the feedback from the written comment period, conduct a hearing to receive verbal testimony from stakeholders, and then to review our next steps.
I think, once again, we'll probably withhold testimony or questions until you're finished with the presentation, since this is not an action item. So we'll let you walk all the way through the presentation before we go to questions, because we are a little behind schedule.
Excellent.
Please proceed.
Thank you. In your board packet, you will have found several documents. Included in those documents, we gave you a memo, which kind of is a large compilation of the materials that you received. Additionally, you will find that there is written feedback in that, the CDE draft responses to that feedback, an exceptions report that clearly points out the large changes that have been made in the rules. And then you will also find a draft of the rules with track changes on it. Remember, the rules right now are about 300 and some pages with track changes. As you accept those track changes, it does come down a little bit smaller to about 200 and some pages, right at 300. So this is a large endeavor. I will just remind us that it's a large endeavor. So as we go forward, I wanted to just remind you a little bit about why are we updating these rules. There was a very clear call from our stakeholders across multiple areas of education in Colorado for us to take a look at our rules and update it to current state statute and best practice. That feedback included our educators, our educator preparation entities, and our district leadership. The rule revisions also brought alignment, or are bringing alignment, of several of our statutory initiatives, which include Senate Bill 212 and Senate Bill 191. Those respectively outline the student standards and the educator standards and evaluation. During this process, we were able to make revisions also to clear up language and or any other items that were associated with not appropriate statutory recommendations. Thus far, the rulemaking process has included feedback and input and draft development, which occurred from May 2014, so this has been an extended period of time, May 2014 through August of 2015. In September of 2015, the board initiated the formal feedback and formal rulemaking process. Written comments were taken from September 9th of 2015 through October 21st of 2015. Those comments were submitted to the State Board, and then they were passed along. As a reminder, you have a summary document in your packet that has all of those written feedback pieces in their entirety. Today, we will take a look at the updated drafts, but more than anything, today we're really listening to feedback from our audience members about the process and or anything else in the rules that they want to comment on. Just as a summary of your written comments, there were approximately only 18 comments that were submitted. Of those comments, there were really mostly comments around fundamental, you know, questions around how does this really work for us? What would this really look like if we were to implement it? There were a majority of those comments that were just simply clarifications, or they were calling out some small changes that they were requesting with regard to wording. The majority of the comments were also associated with statutory references. So I think it's important to know just kind of what was the general comment structure. Of those two, there were some substantive requests. The first one was really our director of special education. That particular one was actually a copy and paste error. So you will see in your feedback that they said, is this really what the director of special education should be doing? There was a copy and paste error associated literally with a gifted and talented piece. So you will see several letters like that, and we clarified that your updated drafts have been corrected to reflect those changes. The other one was really around our educational interpreter authorization. You will see several letters or written pieces of feedback around educational interpreters. I think what you'll hear today is that this is still somewhat of a large conversation that remains on the table. I believe you will also hear some testimony from some of those folks that are coming to the table making some recommendations. So with all of that noted, and knowing that you have a very large packet full of rules, draft rules, exception reports, and written comments and feedback, I'd be very interested to take any of your comments that you have or questions that you have about the material that's presented to you today before we go to the hearing.
Questions? Yes. Dr. Schroeder?
Well, being very far from someone who knows much about special education, I tried to understand the letters about educational interpreter authorization. And what I didn't hear or wasn't able to find was what level of expertise is necessary in order to properly serve kids. What I heard about, I thought I read, were shortages. But that didn't seem to me, I mean, that part didn't resonate so much as are our prep programs for this position inadequate? Is that where we, you know, what are we really talking about? Because ultimately our concern, it is about shortages, but it's really about do we have people serving the needs of our kids? What I don't understand, and I didn't understand, it was alluded to, but it's not something I understand very well, are the legal requirements. And so it worries me a lot that we might be making an argument around shortages when, in fact, we have a legal obligation to provide a higher level. Our instructors need to have a higher level of competence than we're willing to accept. So I got a little twisted in trying to understand all that. Maybe today's, right now, is not the answer as we, or maybe the answer will come as we hear from folks. What is it that kids need? This is called educational interpreter
Authorization,
and if you want to explain what that is, I think I understood what it is. It has something to do with kids who don't
it
hear.
It is. Okay. For our deaf and hard of hearing students, there is an educational interpreter that does sign for them, and so that is something that any of our schools are required by IDEA, so by our special education law, to engage in part of their instructional methodology so that they can interpret for any of our deaf students. I think, Dr. Schroeder, that is an incredible question and one that is the continued conversation that we're having. I think, again, testimony today may help us with some of that. We've started engaging in conversations about how the educator interpreter authorization is really kind of that middle ground of we need somebody to be able to interpret just what the teacher is saying, except for the fact that this is an educational environment in which it's not just what they're saying, it's really about the pedagogy behind that. And so I think coming forward, one of the recommendations that people have had is actually creating another layer of a teacher. And so that's where a lot of our conversation really needs to come forward. And I agree with you that I think we need to have a really honest conversation about what's best for our kids.
And when we have that conversation, can we make sure that you get it to a level of dummies like me who have not had, I don't think I've had any encounter with this at all. So please make it kind of basic.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Dr. Shuffle.
So can I just get the right frame? Is this true that we are opening up the whole of the Colorado Educator Licensing Act of 1991 for revisions? in all areas, correct?
Thank you, Dr. Scheffel. That is actually, there are two separate entities. The Act itself is a legislative requirement that we are not touching right now. That literally lives over with our legislators.
But no, but what I mean is the rules that are associated with it.
Correct.
We are opening up the rules.
We are
broadly
opening,
speaking.
Yes, we have opened, you're correct.
Okay.
We have opened up the rules, broadly speaking, for, and I've talked a little bit about this, so I want to make sure that it's very clear, for alignment purposes today, not for holistic changes. So those were the three, and I'm going to say this word. I'm going to say bucket. I'm going to say it. Dr. Flores, I apologize, but I am going to use a bucket. But there are three buckets that the feedback over the course of the last year have definitely come forward. So the first bucket is really about alignment with current state statute, and it's really about best practices, alignment here. The second bucket is really about there have been a lot of conversations that have come forward regarding additional endorsements or additional pathways or more, you know, stronger career opportunities for our teachers. That's really sitting in what I am considering bucket two today. And then there is a third bucket that is truly, as we've listened to the feedback, we will absolutely admit that there have been people who have come to the table that said, I think we do need to take a look at the Act itself in law. We have set that over while we're collecting information. We are absolutely not acting on it because that is part of our legislators' responsibility kind of across the way. So we've been collecting that information, but we really haven't migrated towards it at all. As far as, I'm sorry.
So, but please. Let me see if I have it straight. We only have 18 comments. This is possibly getting voted on in December. We're opening up the rules broadly for the Licensing Act of 1991, which hasn't, I think the last time we did that was, what, 5 years ago? And do we have to relook at those rules every 5 years, or that's just our own cycle?
I think that's also a good question. What has prompted this, really, is that the people have noted that there's a misalignment associated with them. We have, this has been a year-long process, actually, from May of 2014. It's been about a year-and-a-half process from May of 2014. We started focus groups and feedback, and we had surveys that were associated with it. So while there are only 18 comments with regard to the written feedback, beginning last year in September, so September of 2014 through November of 2014, we held focus groups across the state of Colorado. From that, we had about 788 comments that came from that, in which it went to a new draft in December. So then we took that new draft and we created a survey on top of it around that new draft, and we identified, the numbers are going to elude me and I don't have them in my head right now, a couple hundred additional requests for updates. So we've gone back to all the stakeholders. In June of this year, we developed yet one more draft. We posted it for public comment and created a survey and ability for them to insert survey. From that draft, we had approximately probably only 20 to 25 comments that came back for it. So this is, yet again, our formal rulemaking hearing that has started in.
So we're not probably going to be looking at these rules for another 5 years, is that correct? Unless there's some nuance, you know,
so
cleanup type language.
I think that's
that
a good...
Right?
Here's what I will say.
Is I'm
I think,
trying to get a frame for how important this is.
How
it strikes
is this?
Me as very important.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think to say, well, it's just alignment. I think there's, I haven't read this line by line, but I mean, it strikes me that there will be a lot of issues in here to talk about. I think in terms of voting in December, I mean, I really need time to go through it line by line and look at the implications, and I'm just wondering from your perspective, do you see 10% of this document having changed substantially? Or you, I mean, I think what we're talking about is sort of, oh, well, it's just being aligned. I'm not so sure. Can you speak to that?
I can. Thank you. I think, let's see, I heard kind of three questions in there. One is kind of how much of this document has been updated and aligned.
Substantively changed. What are we looking for in here, though? I will read it line by line.
Sure. I think that's the exceptions document. That's one of the reasons that we gave you the kind of a matrix of the exceptions document. It looks a little bit like this. And that's really the one that says, you know what, these are the massive changes throughout. I would say that we're running at about 25% of the rules that have actually had any massive changes with regard to outcomes associated with them. The rest of the document was really about updating either requirements associated with the legislature or even aligning language so that we could really see that it was in alignment with Senate Bill 191. So that's kind of the first question. So I'd say about 25% of that document. The second question, how often should these be reviewed? They actually should be reviewed annually. So them not coming to the board for this extended period of time is somewhat of an interesting conundrum for us. We would have wanted to bring it forward just a little bit faster as we listened to the initiatives and everything
Excuse
that was moving.
Me, you said they, who is they who didn't come forward?
I would have to say it's my unit.
Oh.
It would have been me and my predecessor. Those are the individuals that would have needed to come forward, so me and my predecessor. So
I guess I'm just saying, as we begin this discussion, I just guess I'd like to make sure that we're hitting on the important issues that occurred in these focus groups, because I haven't reviewed all the minutes from those focus groups. I'm not sure we even have that, to know the subtext of the linguistic changes that are always, there's always what's written and then what's underneath that in terms of what was the discussion, what's the implication of the language change. And I think if we just focus on, hey, some people would like a director of SPED endorsement and an education interpreter authorization, I think we're kind of missing really what went on in those meetings. So as we have time to think through it, let's make sure we get to the substance of the discussions that occurred before we see this document.
Well, I think
thank you.
I think Dr. Scheffel understands it, but I'm still kind of dealing with it. So you are recodifying this thing? I mean, that's basically you're going through and saying this has to be struck out, this has to be... That would be a good idea. I would, if you could get all the rules that are worthless and make problems and.
So, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Flores, I think many of our rules, and you guys have been doing this over the past several months, many of our rules come to you to be updated for alignment issues. Actually, our Office of Legal Services periodically reviews all of the state board rules and checks for alignment and those sorts of things. So, actually, the whole start of this really was that these rules haven't been updated in a while, and so we really do need to look at them for an alignment and a clear statutory linkage. So these have this truly is an alignment issue. I think some other things are coming up.
So Dr. alignment is a kind of a recodify.
You could say that, yes. I mean, it's updating the rules to make sure that they are in line with state statute and they are referencing the proper statutes relevant to this work. So the other thing I just wanted to say is that this is entirely up to you, board, in terms of how long you want this process to go. We've provided you with all of the information about the feedback we've gotten from stakeholders. We've provided you with an exceptions report so you don't have to go through the 300-page document if you don't want to. And you can see exactly where we've made changes. But it's totally up to you if you want to have a vote on in December or if you would like to push that vote to January or February. That's up to you around how much feedback you want to hear, how many hearings you would like to have. That's your prerogative. So you can make that choice once you hear some of the feedback today.
All right. Further questions? Yes, Ms. Goff.
Related to that, I would need to ask you to... How does that work with timing issues? I mean, if we're talking about trying to get things set for interpreters or speech and language work employees in general, how does this work with timelines? We're in December coming up here. Hiring needs to start processing pretty soon. We've got educators, prospective or current, who are very much at stake in whatever these decisions are. I guess, appreciate and I do truly appreciate the extension opportunity, but I think we need to be pretty concerned about how it works on the ground and how does this affect districts that are trying to straighten out this type of information. And then I would just ask, and this does not require an answer right now. In fact, is this an appropriate time in your presentation to talk maybe a little specifically about the interpreter job description? Because I think, I'll just give you, and you could ponder this and think about it later, but is there a difference between this position? I know the answer. I'm sorry. But is there a difference between this position as we're speaking about licensure and American Sign Language teachers. What are some of the differences in criteria, requirement, background needed, that sort of thing? I think those are the kinds of, perhaps, occasionally, if not more, people will ask us, how do we know, where is the focus here, and what is the actual purpose of this change, and why? That would be my type of question. If it's not appropriate this part, if you're not finished with your process yet, I completely understand. Thank you. Just, I appreciate the timeline about this. So I don't think we need to be doing this into May.
Yes. Thank you. Dr. Shuffle.
Right, and I agree, and I'm not trying to slow it down unnecessarily. All I'm saying is there's a lot of language here. And I think it strikes me as more substantive than just alignment. And universities sit with this language in rooms, papering the walls, and developing courses against this language. And I just think there's some rich discussions to have to find out, are we overburdening universities by saying you need to have a program in whatever and have this many credit hours because that's the only way to reach, you know, proficiency for students on all this language? And I don't know the answer because I need to look at it critically. But I'm just saying I hate to rush through it because it has huge implications for those that must align with this language to have approved programs in the state of Colorado.
That's right. I mean, earlier we were talking about interpreters, just interpreters in other languages. And the question was asked, do we have, does somebody certify them here? Mm. And the question was, well, I don't know. I don't think anybody knew, but, you know, that I know Arizona and New Mexico have a certification program. And, I mean, if we're doing it for sign, wouldn't we do it for just regular languages?
Yes. Thank you. Do you want anybody want to answer that?
No.
Okay. Katie's, no, don't want to answer that one. Okay. Thank you very much. We'll take it into consideration and take a look at the rules in alignment with that. Thank you.
Ms. Rankin?
When we use the term alignment, what does that mean? Aligned with standards or aligned with what?
Thank you. I think that's a good question as well, because what we did is we aligned with current best practices, which could be standards and at a national level, and we aligned with current state statutes that we did not have alignment before. So my best example of that alignment really is Senate Bill 191, where we have teacher, principal, and special service quality standards, and those were not articulated in our rules at all. As a matter of fact, they were a completely different set of standards. Some of them very closely matched, but they were not in alignment. So we had our educator preparation entities over here preparing our teachers to do this, but the expectations of an evaluation system that really helps support and coach teachers over here. So that was really part of the alignment, was simply literally we take it out and we replace it with the standards and the expectations of today.
So I understand the accountability in 191, but if this was done couple years ago or started a year ago, what about the standards that we have in place now that the students are being tested on? Is this aligned with them? And I'm specifically thinking the technology that's involved in these and the teachers not being able to use it or being able to use it when they come out of school. I'm sure you have thoroughly exhausted that.
We have indeed aligned the standards to our Colorado academic standards, and that was one of the reasons that we took a look at some of our others that were not part of Colorado academic standards. So we did an alignment with those, and then we've also taken a look at some of our national standards, and ISTE happens to be one of them, which is the International Society of Technology Education. So that actually has to be, that's one of them, for us to be able to align our standards for our teacher prep programs.
Okay.
I do want to say, just as a short aside, we tried very hard not to make these large-scale changes that would drastically impact if we did not need to. And I don't think there was any area that we could go down that said, this is a completely a whole new program. That was not part of the case. Again, that kind of sits in that second bucket as we go forward.
Okay, which bucket does it exist that if teachers need to be trained in a certain way, some of these things that we're doing now cannot be done Wednesday afternoon during teacher development. And was that taken into consideration?
So the rules that we have today are really around our educator preparation programs and how we license a teacher. And there was no conversation, because it sits in statute, no conversation really about professional development. or anything that runs along that line. And that, you know, some of that is, it's such a local control decision, and so many districts have that choice at a professional development in-service day to make that decision. There was really no conversation at a state level around that. I do think there was plenty of feedback that we heard from folks talking about renewal of licenses. It is not sitting on the table today. And about how do we renew licenses, or what kind of levers, and I will always say that, we have a strong lever to renew a license for our professional development. What it means really in today's world to have professional development, that is not something on the table today, but we have heard feedback about it, yes.
Okay, and I just have one more question. How many different alternate or teacher's licenses? I've asked this before. What are the numbers on that? How many different ones do we have in our state?
Clarify your question. How many different programs do we have for that?
Like if I,
endorsements, are you?
Endorsements. No. Thank you. That's the word. That's the word.
Number of endorsements. I'm going to turn around for a second.
Think it's endorsements.
You're right. You're right.
There, I was going to say just alternative high 40s. Thank you. Approximately in the high 40s, number of endorsements. Now, the variation associated with that could be pretty large.
And those come up as needed, as necessary, specifically from the districts?
Individual endorsements, yes.
Okay, so there's like 40 endorsements. Is that, and then, of course, the alternate license is different?
Alternative license is the same. It's just the pathway in which you get to the end. So our current, our four-year, what you might consider a traditional program, really is a four-year program in the grand scheme of things. Some of them are actually three, some are four,
yeah,
some are
sure.
five. But when we look at our alternative programs, there are two types of alternative programs. One is a pathway that is a one-year pathway, which means I am on the job, I am already teaching in my classroom, I am the teacher of record, and I'm getting the pedagogical training behind that.
That 1 year is going to give me that background.
1 year is going to give me that background.
Okay.
And then there is a two-year program that also does that, that's okay. More of a teacher-in-residence model.
How many of those do we have in our state?
In alternative in general, I believe there is 24 right now.
Okay.
Every day people are asking for more and more and more. We have at least three sitting on the counter right now with folks asking, can we become an alternative agency?
Okay. Thank you.
And does that include the 6-weekend administrator certification?
That it is inclusive in that, and it depends. Some of them are cohort-based educational administration programs from our institutes of higher education that may be, like I said, a year or year and a half program. So some are traditional and some are alternative.
Perhaps the easiest way to clarify this for the members, because this is extensive, would be if you would take areas where there have been a change made that would require, and let's just use the interpreter as the example.
Okay.
If there's a change that affects interpreters, and I presume that's an endorsement, that you would list the interpreter endorsement and the consequences. Current licensees would have to do X to maintain that endorsement. Future endorsements, that we've increased the requirements in this fashion, there's more coursework, more something.
Higher score.
So that we could, I think the only way we're ever going to be able to evaluate it is on that basis. And if you take, I don't know how many of the 40 endorsements are affected by this.
Do they have a test?
But, you know, which are the ones that are affected? What's the consequence of the change, both to the education institution that is providing the training and to the applicant? And I think if we get it in that framework, it'll be a lot simpler for us to judge, is this too onerous? And if that change is required by statute to make it more onerous, that's one thing. If it's a gratuitous change being brought about by aligning with, and I'm not a great fan of national
exams?
Well, not exams, but probably the best example is you always have the response time for firefighters. That the appropriate response time, guess who sets that? That's a group made up of insurance company and firemen. They don't necessarily share the same interests as the taxpayer. So we need to, if we're going to align with some in some national norm, I'd like to know that's the reason. If it's statutorily required, that's an entirely different reason. We have to do that. But anything that's gratuitous should be noted. If we don't have to do it, we should take a look, a hard look at whether or not we do it. So I think if you could put it in that framework, this document, because it doesn't name, it just doesn't get to those specifics. So I think when you're ready, when you have that, we'll put this back on the agenda for approval. And so when we've had an adequate time to look at that particular thing. In the meantime, are there further questions before we take testimony? Is there anyone present who would like to testify? Apparently we have a list, Ms. Burson. Lelina Johnson? Did I miss? I apologize if I mispronounced.
It's close enough.
Close enough for government work. Okay.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I really appreciate this opportunity to address the issue of educational interpreter qualifications. My name is Dr. Leilani Johnson, and I'm the director of the Department of American Sign Language and Interpreting Studies at the University of Northern Colorado. Since 1993, I have been engaged in developing and technologically delivering educational opportunities for individuals who want to be highly qualified educational interpreters working with students who are deaf and hard of hearing. I have managed contracts with 22 state education agencies. We have solicited and administered almost $20 million in federal and state funds that paid for the education of those individuals. And so this is something that I feel very passionate about. In 1997, Colorado had much to be proud of because we were the third state in the nation to set a standard for educational interpreters. But today we can't celebrate that achievement because we have two decades of research that shows the barriers that these children face from the standards that are currently in place. The research is so overwhelming that our professional organization requires a bachelor's degree in order to sit for a national exam. Our accrediting body will no longer accredit two-year interpreter preparation programs, and the U.S. Department of Education will not award personnel preparation funds unless the institution has a four-year interpreter education program. So times have changed since 1997. An educational interpreter is classified in IDEA as related service personnel. In Colorado, it's known as a specialized service provider. Other services in this category include the school nurse, the school counselor, occupational therapist, right? And all of these require a minimum of a rigorous pre-service baccalaureate program in the discipline, an internship in an educational setting, documentation of their professional competence, an induction experience in the school system, and then continuing professional development. They're also held accountable for the quality of their services through some kind of established standardized evaluation system. Educational interpreters must be recognized as the special services providers that the law identifies them as. And as such, they need to be held accountable to these same five minimum standards. This matter can't be postponed any longer, and I respectfully request that the board task CDE licensing under Dr. Colleen O'Neill to facilitate stakeholder meetings at the earliest possible time in order to align the requirements for educational interpreters, just as they have with all the rest of the disciplines that support children. Colorado students who are deaf and hard of hearing deserve a highly qualified educational interpreter. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Sarah Kennedy.
Hello, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. I'm wearing two hats today. I'm the mom of a deaf child making her way through a Colorado Springs school district, and I'm the director of a parent resource group called Hands and Voices that represents families raising deaf and hard of hearing children all over the state of Colorado. For our kids who are deaf or hard of hearing and use sign language, the interpreter is the main connection, not only to the school community and the people, but the written materials that a child must learn to master. They're learning two languages, American Sign Language and English. And the complexity comes when 95% of those children are born to hearing parents like myself who've never met a deaf person, who never used sign language before. I taught myself a little Braille in high school, but I was really on the wrong track. Hearing loss is this amazing, complex journey of language development. And when I think about folks with AA degrees, it reminds me of the skill and level of a receptionist in front of all the people that person must meet in a medical office. You know, we put people in the public with the least training and the least preparation in the most important task sometimes. And that just reminds me of that role of the interpreter. Sometimes a child develops understandable speech, but they still, because there's no hearing aid or equipment that has yet been invented that takes account for the fan noise sitting next to the exhaust system on the projector in a classroom, or the noise and the echo from the hard surfaces, they just can't receive all the information from a teacher auditorily. You know, why ask kids to use their most difficult sense to get their information? Even more damaging, I think, is the assumption that if we give a child an interpreter, we've given them good access. Placed with an interpreter who has an AA degree and an average of a 3.1 score on the assessment, this child is believed to have access, but in reality, research shows they get less than 65% of the message from the certified teacher in the classroom, let alone from the ability to overhear everyone else in the classroom discuss a text, or even talk about, what are you doing this weekend? Can you come to my birthday party? All of that. I could tell you more stories. I can point to other states, like our neighbors in Nebraska, who are raising their standards right now as we speak. I could talk about the perfect storm coming with the Americans with Disabilities Act that in December released an opinion guidance paper that says our kids deserve equal access to their hearing peers. That's different than the IDEA that asks for a basic level of opportunity. Equal access. Think about that. Think if there was a deaf person in this room. It's not just placing an interpreter here, but the quality of the audio visuals and the ability of that interpreter to prepare the message with this very complex task. I see I'm out of time, but I want to say this is a good chance to make a legacy for the board. You can make a difference here in one measurable part of deaf education. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Donna Trujillo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Asp, and State Board members for the opportunity to provide testimony today. My name is Donna Trujillo, and I am a Director of Personalized Learning with Douglas County School District. I am here to represent I'm testing on behalf of the Consortium of Special Education Directors formed in 2004 to help policymakers understand issues related to children with disabilities. Our membership consists of 100% of the districts and administrative units in Colorado. This testimony also represents CASE, CASB, CEA, the Colorado BOCES Association, and the Colorado Rural Schools Alliance. Each of our organizations appreciates the opportunity to give feedback to CDE staff and that the current proposed language reflects consideration of some of the concerns we raised. We also recognize the work of many stakeholders that has gone into the proposed rules. Each of our organizations has a strong support for quality services for students who are deaf and hard of hearing or hard of hearing. In no way should our concerns be construed as lacking support for these students. As stated in our two letters, we have serious concerns about considering raising the standards for educational interpreters and transliterators. Over the years, there has been a significant statewide shortage in this area. Increasing the requirements for certification from the current 3.5 minimum score to 4.0 and from an associate's degree to a bachelor's will create an even greater shortage in qualified staff than currently exists. Even with the current standards, the issues facing districts and AUs to solve the shortage are complex. This month, the consortium completed a statewide survey of districts and found, with 85% of districts responding, that at the start of the school year, there were 56 interpreter vacancies statewide, and there are still 46 positions vacant, both in rural and urban areas. These vacancies exist despite exhaustive efforts to recruit and retain interpreters, to hire from private agencies, and to reassign staff with signing skills. According to a preliminary Special Education Fiscal Advisory Committee analysis of CDE data, there is a $520 million gap in funding necessary to meet current requirements. Increased qualifications for interpreters will also have the unintended consequence of requiring local districts and AUs to fund the widening gap. Currently, many districts report spending tens of thousands of dollars beyond their budgets since the start of the school year to bring in private agency staff, some of whom don't meet the current state qualifications, including from hiring from an agency all the way in Nebraska. Others report having to send students to the Colorado School for the Deaf and Blind because there are no educational interpreters in this area. One director reminds us all that the highest cost is more than financial. It's that children are separated from their families and communities. Districts in rural areas report a common theme of no applicants or private agency staff available for contracting at any cost, and they often have to use paraprofessionals with limited signing skills. Despite active recruitment and advertising, these vacancies are ongoing from year to year. We respect the intent of increasing the quality of interpreter performance, but increasing requirements will only increase the current critical shortage. We urge that the current requirements remain in place. We support continued ongoing and intensive professional development efforts differentiated by region to build existing capacity. We also urge continued partnerships with CDE, higher education, and local districts and AUs to implement creative practices for recruitment and retention of interpreters. Shifting gears a little bit, in a second area of significant concern for the consortium, we appreciate that CDE recognized the need to revise and correct the proposed rules for the Director of Gifted Education Endorsement. This entailed correcting proposed changes to the Director of Special Education Endorsement, Section 10.05. However, we noted that the proposed language in Section 10.05, subparagraph 2, includes a requirement to have completed a minimum of 2 years' experience working with students with exceptional academic and talented aptitude. To many in the special education field, this would mean students who are gifted and talented. This is also the same language proposed as a requirement for the Director of Gifted Education Endorsement in Section 10.06, subparagraph 2. We strongly oppose the proposed language change and urge that it remain as it is currently written, requiring directors of special education to have a minimum of 2 years working with students with disabilities. All of us represented in this testimony remain committed to work with CDE staff around solutions to these important issues. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Trejo. We appreciate your comments. All right, I think at this point we will take this off the table. We will ask staff to prepare the document in the form that I requested and make sure to flag areas where there are not only change, but additionally where there's clearly controversy, where you received conflicting comments.
Feedback.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll proceed to... Where was I? There. We'll proceed to item 7, post-secondary and workforce readiness discussion. Okay, that's good. All right, Mr. Commissioner, I'd like to introduce this particular program.
As you'll hear from Gretchen Morgan and Misty Rufin, in the process, you heard it from Lieutenant Governor today, process of revising the current definition of post-secondary and workforce readiness. The Colorado Commission on Higher Education has been working on that process parallel to you, and I'll turn it over to Gretchen Morgan to get us started on this.
Thank you. So, hello again, Gretchen Morgan from the department. And today, this is just an information item for you. We'll be bringing you a decision in December, but didn't want to do that without having some time just for you to get a little bit of background. So, today is just brief background. So,
did you say you'll be coming back with a decision?
A decision item for you in December. I unfortunately am not the person with the authority to make the decision. That would be fun if I had all of those. Yes, it is you who has that authority. It is you.
Go for it.
So, quick background. As the Lieutenant Governor referenced this morning, every 6 years, statute requires that this definition is revisited. And this is a definition which is mutually determined, actually, by this board and the Colorado Commission on Higher Education. So, we have begun this process really last spring of trying to revisit the current definition so that we're ready to have a new one on time based on statutory requirements. The definition up here is the one that is current, which was created in 2009. And I'm going to start to talk to you now a little bit about the process we've gone through to update that. So the process really has had two components, one of which is convening and one of which is surveying. And so this first slide is about the convening portion of things. We have had two different face-to-face convenings with groups of over 200 stakeholders, including people in all of these categories. And I'm excited to say that two of the elected officials were Dr. Schroeder and Dr. Flores, who joined us for the second of these two convenings. So thank you very much for spending time with us on that. Very much appreciated. But the goal was to try and make sure that we had a really well-rounded group of people contributing to this conversation. There had been some memories from some people of the last process feeling like that maybe was a little too focused on education and didn't have some of these other people participating. And so we tried to just be very representative in who we had at the table. And I'm pleased to say that we really did get strong participation from all of these different stakeholder groups. In fact, I think some of them may want to come and talk to you in December when you have this as a decision because they were deeply involved. So as I said before, in addition to those convenings, we had a series of surveys. So the first survey we did was prior to any of the convenings, and it was asking people to just give feedback about components from the existing definition that they really felt strongly about, that they would like this group as they convened to consider and take seriously as they sort of looked forward. We shared that information with the stakeholder groups the first time we convened them. And then after that, as the group sort of started raising up ideas about definitions, we had a second survey. This was after the second convening, so we had maybe eight or so groups that each had generated a proposed definition in the second convening. We put that out in a broad survey to people. We had we sent it to around 2,000 people. We got about 500 back, which I actually felt pretty great about, actually. That's a pretty good return on a survey. And in that survey, we had these two things come out as the you know, most popular, I guess, of the options among the different definitions generated by these working groups. And so these two definitions, which I'm not going to read to you because you have them in front of you and everyone else has them in the board docs, were the two most strongly recommended, and they were equally recommended. So this is, these two together represent 69% of all votes, and they were both, you know, 34% and a little bit of change to get to that 69. So they were very evenly liked from people, which of course puts us in a conundrum because then it's like, well, which one is best? So we did what people often in this situation try to do, which is to combine them, or at least to combine the key components of them without creating something which is monstrously long. You can decide how well you think we did with that. So we have here at the top of this slide our best effort to try and pull together the key components of these definitions. And when we shared this with CCHE, some people who I presume are language arts and English professors, me to say. That's who that was. Came up to us and enthusiastically offered us some further edits. And so what you have, they did. They were excited for a chance to do some editing. I think it's fun for them. So they suggested some changes, and this bottom one that's here is what came back from that discussion with those folks from CCHE. So what we've done now is, prior to meeting with CCHE, we had put out, you know, the two first front runners and this combined possibility for a final survey, which you all also have received the link to. And we're hoping that we get great response to that one, just like we did the last time. And we anticipate when we come back to you in December, we'll have two pieces of information for you. One will be the result of that final survey, and the second will be what CCHE decided to do with this, because they're going to take it on for a decision at their December meeting, which comes just days before your December meeting. And I want to say, in terms of process, plan A of process is you each consider this separately, and then maybe there is a awesome governmental process miracle in which you agree to the same definition, which would be lovely. We're trying that because the logistics of getting you all together, actually as a joint meeting, are just very difficult. And so we thought we would try it as a plan A. If that doesn't work, of course, and if you have strong feelings about what they bring forward and you want to suggest some changes, we will pull you together and convene you as a full group to be able to sort that out and come to some agreement. But we thought we would just start with this method and see if that worked just in the interest of everyone's time. So that's what we have right now. And CCHE's maybe will be the only one I read out, because it seems like the leading contender right now, although it'll be exciting to find out when we come back in December. But currently, this is what they've generated. In partnerships with families, communities, schools, and business, Colorado high school graduates demonstrate the competencies, knowledge and skills, needed to succeed in post-secondary settings and to advance in economically viable career pathways as both lifelong learners and contributing citizens. So there you have it. So today, if you want to ask questions about this, about the process or what's in here, you're welcome to do that. But as I said, mostly I just wanted to make sure today I could give you some brief background on this, so this isn't coming to you for a decision in December without you having had some background.
Questions on this issue? Yes, Dr. Schroeder.
Well, I'll pass on the questions, but I'll comment, having great, participated great. In this, that I certainly sensed a change in the comments from the higher ed folks. I think there's actually been a shift in many of the members of the higher education community who've come forward to be able to speak to something beyond college. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be extremely positive, because for such a long time we just talked about getting our kids to and through college, mm-hmm. and not beyond. And the conversation, at least at my table, was this definition's got to talk about the fact that there is life, we hope, for our kids past college.
Right.
And that they, and how they move on in their careers, et cetera. So I just thought that it was pretty dramatic, having participated in all this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. since forever, since the 90s when we were doing standards. Mm-hmm. I think that's very, very helpful.
Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Scheffel.
Can you talk about where this definition shows up and the work that it impinges on?
Oh, sure.
Obviously, in our standards, it's woven throughout. There are a number of documents that will align with this and interpret these words, mm-hmm. in very specific ways.
Yeah,
but
so
it has tentacles.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. The tentacles of this, in terms of K-12, are mostly in connections to standards, although that is, currently there's a set of terms that are called 21st century skills in the standards, and there's something that relates this definition to those skills, so it's not exactly in the standards, but I think there's meant to be some relationship between the two. The second one is actually in the graduation guidelines. This is one of the definitions referenced in that statute as a thing that local boards should consider in coming up with their graduation requirements. There are ideas out there from CCHE about ways they might use this, too. I don't know. You could speak to those, but we've just had some conversations with them about, you know, as they look at entrance requirements and processes like that in the future, like no specific commitment or interest in anything in the very short term, but in the longer term, looking at how this might impact how institutions would think about entrance requirements for students, largely trying to be accommodating also of things that did come up in the graduation guidelines conversations about competencies and wanting to have ways to recognize those for graduates and for entrance for them.
Yeah. So may I follow up?
Yes, please.
So you're saying the two ways this definition shows up in our specific work in K-12, our standards, and also high school graduation rates right now.
Right.
And so would the standards have to be rewritten based on this language as they align with 21st century skills? I know they're not the same, but they are aligned. Mm-hmm.
I think, and this is, I'm talking a little bit out of turn, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but standards revision has its own required timeline and statute. So when we get to that timeline and there is that opportunity for revision, one thing that process could do is to consider this in alignment with this. Is that accurate?
And as far as the meaning of the words, like when we say economically viable career paths, I mean, on the face of it, who wouldn't want that?
Mm-hmm.
But underneath it, then, you know, you're pushing certain careers. And I don't know, I was looking at some of the statistics behind STEM and engineering, mm-hmm. and that's been such a big issue that we need more students who are engineers. And yet when you look at the jobs out there and the really the market being flooded with folks with engineering, from what this article is saying, I mean, I just wonder what are the unintended consequences of this more specific language. I mean, there's a part of me that feels like leave it as broad as possible and let the districts define it. But when you put economically viable, somebody's got to define that. Somebody's got to track that. How long is this career economically viable? Under what conditions is it viable? And then that drives what schools are doing and what high school graduation requirements are looking like. So, I mean, inside this language are, you know, consequences because the definitions. Are there other words that jump out in terms of how people are wanting to define these? I mean, in that respect, I'd like to have that language excised, only because it's the way it's defined will drive behaviors that are hard to track, in a sense, you know, as far as how effective that language is.
Dr. Flores?
Yes, I think you're missing a big part of, well, you're missing individuals. You have individuals. This is the whole thing about life is about an individual searching for meaning. And families have their meaning, and they want to indoctrinate us to communities and schools and businesses and such. Can I use the word indoctrinate? Because, you know, they do. They have. But an individual is a person who really wants to look for something that is, you know, theirs. And so I think you need to add an individual in there. And I think, I mean, when you look back on, you know, curricula, and you look at what is education for, some people would say, first of all, comes the individual, society, or you have knowledge. I mean, you're looking for knowledge. At least that's how I studied it. And so you... The individual is just big. It's missing from here, and we need to put it in there.
Yes.
I was just looking at an excerpt from a screenshot from the United States Department of Labor talking about enabling workforce data to be matched with education data to ultimately create longitudinal data systems with individual-level information beginning in kindergarten through post-secondary schooling all the way through entry and sustained participation in the workforce and employment services system. And that's from the U.S. Department of Labor's own website. And so that this language, I think, drives that longitudinal data system and the linkage between K-12 and the workforce and following a child from kindergarten into the workforce. So I guess as I look at the language, it seems innocuous enough, except that underneath it is this whole initiative to link education with workforce data. And I just think the way we define that, we have to be wise about the implications. And I'm wrestling with that.
Further discussion? Yes, Ms. Herrington. You're going to keep it up, I'm going to tell my jokes.
I'll stop.
I was just wondering, is it in statute that we have to change the definition we already have? Is that what we're going for here?
We just have to review it.
It's in statute that we need to review it. When we engage people and ask them about reviewing, this is what they suggested.
And then we can decide to stay with the old one if we want.
If you wanted to, you could choose to do that.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that was clear because we're at a high level. We're 30,000 feet, and 2009 seems to be just fine. But
again, that's up to you and CCHE to determine mutually.
Yeah.
Well, we'll tell my joke.
Oh, okay.
No,
I'm done.
No, you're right. No after you're finished. Yes.
I think this may be redundant, which makes me a joke, I suppose. But how does this, 6 years from now, let's say, no matter what decision we make, leave alone or move ahead with something different, we have is 2022. And we have graduation guidelines and a whole kind of new cycle of life starting in 2021 with the graduating class of. So there will have been a switch to at least the graduation guideline picture. I don't tend to go down those little troughs. I don't think this has any impact on that. To me, they're high level enough that each of them can forge ahead and go on. But I'm just curious as to how, and I know you will do this, I'm curious as to how this is communicated to districts, to parents, to kids, to those who are involved in ICAP implementation and delivery, and to other interested and important entities in all of this work, and especially students. So, you know, this is what our state says is the way it ought to be for your, what it means to be ready for life. And just trying to keep the timelines in place.
Right.
I don't know whether that's, you know, whether that's the most efficient, human-friendly way to go about lining up, make sure everything's organized and or not. I mean, you know, but to me it's not an issue. I just wanted to emphasize a point, and I'm really not doing it well. I feel it. It's make sure that they are together and that the messaging and the communication makes sense to people. That's
Yeah,
Gretchen,
and I would say, it's okay. I just once you all adopt a definition, our work with it would be to support people in understanding it and determining what they want to do with it in their local graduation requirements. That would be the most pressing process associated with this, and our job would be to just inform them about this and be a resource to them as they consider these things. But obviously, those are totally local decisions about how they would go about making use of this.
And I will say really quickly that the only a handful of comments or just comments back after this went out for public participation. And the only one, the really most substantial one had to do with where in there can we put, its partnership is part of it, very important, but how do we work in the idea of collaboration to continue to push the idea that this is a joint effort among the community and the and educators and students and business people, and that's all. I'm not promoting it one way or the other right now, but that word comes up a lot. Partnership is one thing. Some people see them the same. Some people don't.
As you might imagine, in this process, there was a lot of discussion about subtle perceptions of differences among words, right? This is always how this goes when you're defining things, so there was some discussion about that.
Dr. Schroeder.
So I wanted to try to answer your question about why would we change it. And I think it is in those first words. Rather than just saying this is what a graduate demonstrates and not indicating, Joyce, who does that, there was a desire to say that this is not just the school, the high school, for example, that's going to come up with this college and career-ready kid, but that it's going to be in partnership with the family, the community, business, et cetera. I think that's the substantive change between what we have. And there were folks that felt pretty strongly that it's not just the responsibility of the high school, to ensure that our kids are college and career ready, but that it's a broader responsibility and a broader process. That's the reason for the change that you see. Not the reason why we're changing it. That was somebody else that decided that. But in looking at the original definition, there was a desire to express that this is not just the responsibility of our high schools, but that it is a broader responsibility to prepare our kids.
Dr. Scheffel.
Yeah, and I haven't searched the CDE website on this, but if I were to look at the website under this initiative, would there be white papers and documents that would inform this discussion? Because people didn't come into a room and just tweak this language to say, hey, we should engage parents and families. I mean, look at the Office of Career, Technical, and Adult Education, some of their publications. I mean, there's a lot out there that really is underneath this work. And so I think it kind of leaves us a little bit out of step if we're just thinking this is all we're doing. Really, it's more than that. And I just wonder if you have those papers on your website linked, or, and I think that would give us context for the meaning of this change beyond just, hey, absolutely, let's pull families and communities into it.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, I was just conferring on the side here, but I don't know that those are posted on our website right now, but it's very easy to provide to you all of the materials that were provided to the group before their first meeting and during their first meeting, which was just like there were people from these various backgrounds. There also was information and research from a whole bunch of different backgrounds
Absolutely.
That the group considered. And so that was definitely part of the process, and very happy to share with you links to all of those resources.
I think that's helpful to us as we look at this Sure. kind of information, because it appears one thing, and is that on one level, but actually what's behind it is a fairly intense process with a lot of research, position papers, white papers that others have considered in adjusting this language. And I think we need to be privy to that as we look at the changes.
Okay, further discussion?
One thing.
Yes, Dr. Forrest.
It's language. And I don't know why we would put competencies in there to demonstrate knowledge and skills. I think there probably is something more there. But why put it in parentheses when that's what we mean?
I'm going to dangerously try to speak on behalf of the professors who spoke with us at our last meeting, so I don't want to misrepresent them, but I believe what they were saying was the term competency, the group that produced this talked a lot about what competency means, and they said they would like some parenthetical reference to these things as sort of components of that so that the word competency was understood more clearly in the definition.
Maybe they could just take out competency.
See, and I think common people, I think the common person would say take out competencies because, you know, they're not going to understand that. And so when we know that this is what is meant, knowledge and skills. Competencies is just, to me, it's a word that kind of can be measured. But I don't like that. I don't like things that humans...
I'm not telling it.
So, I mean, it goes back to something that is not positive. So, demonstrates knowledge and skills, and there should be something else, but soul, maybe.
Okay. Any further discussion on this topic? No. Okay, good. All right.
Thank you.
Let's move on to... And you'll bring us back. What are you bringing back?
We are going to bring back to you what CCHE determines, which may be just like what they already determined, or may be different. We'll share with them your feedback, although you didn't like agree as a group to that feedback.
So if we just disagree for the hell of it, we can create a crisis.
And you could do that. And then we'll also bring with you the survey results from the final survey, where we put that final definition out to people.
Why?
In December.
All right, let's take a 5-minute break if we can. Thank you.